Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Classes of Mail. My name is Alan Gygax, and today I'm working from a script for the first time in quite a while, or at least from notes, because I want to make sure I don't miss anything. We had our day two of the rap session, and I know in the last episode I would tell you I'd come in and talk about it, and the first thing to know is that there were no fireworks. Chris Jackson and James Henry did speak at the rap session. But everything was cordial, and it was just rah-rah, and they seemed friendly with Brian Renfro while they were up on the dais, so nothing to report there. The other thing before we get too far into this is I inhaled a little bit of Coke Zero before I started recording, and it is giving me, I keep having to cough it up, so I apologize in advance for any coughing that happens on this episode. Tough luck. In fact, there's some right there. So anyway, this was my first ever NALC convention of any kind. Before this, the only thing that I had been to that was even similar was just branch meetings at my local branch, 2502, Go Las Vegas. And it was really cool to see, like, I had no idea that there were going to be people from all over the West, from all over Region 1, California, Nevada, Hawaii, and I'm not sure if there are any other Utah, and, you know, like, I'm used to going to these things and seeing a lot of people that I know, and I saw like nobody I knew there except for the normal people I see at my own branch meetings, and that it was neat. It was cool to see all these people here for a common purpose, to get this training and to make themselves better and to make our union more functional, and hey, trip to Vegas on top of it, so that's not too shabby. So That was awesome. And, you know, I'd never been to one before, and so I wasn't sure what I should wear, and I was so close to wearing my mailman costume. And, oh my God, am I glad I did not do that, because I would have been the only person there in a mailman costume. And so, pro tip, if you ever go to one of those meetings, do not wear your mailman costume. Just wear, like, normal clothes. You can wear union stuff, and, you know, plenty of people wore that, but, yeah. It is not a place to go in your mailman costume. All right. So the way it was set up is in the morning before the first session, there was a list of possible classes. And the sessions ran from like 8:30 to noon and then from 1:30 to 4 or something like that. I don't remember the exact times. But we got an hour and a half for lunch. And so in the first session, there was four potential classes that you could go to. And they were each in different ballrooms. And so you had to choose which of those four classes you wanted. And then the same thing for the afternoon. And then on the second day, there was a morning session. So I could take as many as three classes. And that was a bummer because there were like eight classes on there that I wanted to take. But, you know, you got to pick and choose. And my first choice, this class about, I don't even remember what it was now, but I went to sign up for it and it was already full. So I went to New Union Steward Training. That was my very first class. That was the one that I talked about a little bit in the last episode that was taught by the Regional Administrative Assistant. And I didn't learn much new in that class. And mainly the teachers just read from the slides, which was kind of lame. There wasn't much interaction. And I didn't learn a lot of new material, which in a way was encouraging because I'm still new to being a union steward and I'm not very good at it. But I knew most of this stuff, and so that was nice. So I don't really have much to report from that class. Then I went to lunch, and then I went to the Article 8 class. And this one had great teachers. It was these two guys. One of them, his name is Alan Rios. And I remember his name because my name is Alan. And then Rios is the other captain on Picard. If you're a Star Trek fan, I highly recommend Picard. But and plus, Rios had this great beard. So anyway, and they were fantastic. They interacted well with each other. The class ran at a good pace, and I learned some there. Had some stuff clarified, but the class was mainly focused on forced overtime, on like mandates. And we don't get a lot of those at my station, and frankly, I don't find them all that complicated. Like, it just seems pretty straightforward. Like, if you're not on the overtime list and you get mandated, that's a grievance, except under very specific circumstances, which management rarely follows. So that was the first day. And then on day two, I signed up for a class about interviewing management and carriers. And this is something that's new to me. I've only interviewed management once, and it went really well, and I had great questions, but you know, I didn't really know what I was doing. I was pretty well over my skis on that one. So I went to this class, and this woman was teaching it, and I don't remember her name either, but she was really good. And from listening to this class and participating, I realized that as a steward, I was leaving so much fruit on the vine. My grievances could have been so much better. I mean, I've won my grievances, but I could have won them more. You know, like, for example, I had an attendance case that I got knocked down to a letter of warning, but I probably could have gotten that discipline removed completely because of some mistakes that management made, and I just didn't know how to maximize that and how much I should really push for. And that, you know, that's part of the learning process. So with interviews, the benefit of the interviews is that it rounds out the file. It shows where the actual harm took place. And it explains to anybody who's seeing the case down the road, like, why it's important. And again, I just wasn't doing this in my cases because I'm this rules guy, and it's this personality flaw that I have where, hey, if management broke the rules, I'm going to show that they broke the rule, and that's it, and that's the case, and it's settled. That's that. But it's not always that easy. And sometimes even if management breaks the rules, you know, they may not think it's very important, or they may think like, oh, who cares? It's no big deal. No, I'm not going to throw this out just because, or I'm not going to pay this carrier just because, or whatever. And these interviews can really help to prove that management didn't do the right things and that the carriers were actually harmed. So one example of that is like for forced overtime, for an Article 8 violation. You want to interview the carrier who got forced to work that overtime and find out, you know, did maybe that carrier had to pick up his kid from soccer practice. And because he got sent back out to go work more overtime, now the kid had to just sit there at the soccer field with the coach for an hour after practice waiting for his dad to come pick him up. And that's real harm. And that's the kind of thing where, like, that carrier can't get that time back. He can't go back, undo that overtime and pick up that kid. And so that's where compensation for breaking the contract comes into play. So statements like that help to tell that story. And you can even get statements from the carriers who wanted to work that overtime. And they say, like, you know, that's why I signed up on the list. And, you know, I need that money for X, Y, and Z. And now I don't get it because management, you know, screwed up. So the statements from carriers are important. But the problem with statements, so let me back up for a second about statements. We have issues at my station, like with management being abusive, especially to CCAs. And so a CCA will come up to me and they'll complain about, oh, management said this to me, and or they're making me do that, and that's not okay. And I'm like, yeah, you're right, that's not okay. Write me a statement and I'll file a grievance on it. And then they never write the statement. Well, what I learned in this class is that statements aren't all they're cracked up to be, because carriers don't really write good statements in many cases. They write a statement that says, like, oh, this manager doesn't like me, and they're just out to get me, and you know, a couple weeks ago when I was doing that, you know, like all this irrelevant details and all this personal feelings that go in there that just don't help your case. And so instead, they should be guided interviews, you know, where you ask the carrier, like, well, you know, did you work this day? Did you have any interactions with the supervisor? What did the supervisor say to you? And the questions have to be not leading questions where, like, did the supervisor call you a jerk? You say, what did the supervisor say? Because anybody who's looking at that case down the road can see if you're just leading the interviewee to say whatever you want them to say. So writing good questions and getting them answered by your interview subjects is super helpful. And so now going forward, I'm not going to just tell my CCAs or anybody, well, write me a statement, I'll do something about it. Instead, what I'm going to do is put in for like 10 minutes of union time. I'm going to put a little list of questions together, and then I'm going to take that carrier into the break room, and I'm going to ask them those questions, and that's how the case is going to move forward. Because then as a steward, I can direct where I want those questions to go, and I can make sure that what I get out of that carrier is what I actually need to make my case. And so that was, it was really useful to learn those skills. And then another thing about statements is the statements of harm have to come from the aggrieved party. It has to come from the person who is affected. Because if I say John was harmed when this happened, that's just hearsay. It doesn't count for anything. I can say whatever I want. It doesn't mean anything. But if it comes from John, yeah, I was harmed, and this is the way it made me feel, that makes a much stronger case to whoever is deciding this this grievance. So interviews, definitely the way to go. So I'll give you an example how this is going to change what I do as a steward. We have CCAs are crossing craft at my station, and they're throwing parcels in the morning, which in a way is needed because our parcels are running behind and we need the parcels thrown, but that's supposed to be a clerk job. And that's kind of a separate issue. Well, let me talk about it now because I don't know when else I'll talk about it, and I need your guys' advice. My reading of, I think it's Article 7 of the contract, is that we have crafts for a reason. And if you're in the clerk, or if you're in the carrier craft, you shouldn't be doing clerk craft work. But CCAs are often tasked with doing that work. So one time we had a business agent assistant come into our union steward meeting for a training, and they specifically said, like, hey, if you have CCAs who are throwing parcels, you need to file that grievance. But at our local level, our union president is like, no, we don't file that grievance because we're just happy CCAs are getting the hours. And I can see the wisdom of that, but breaking the contract is still breaking the contract. And, you know, as much as, like, I know most places CCAs are getting all the hours they could possibly want, but here we've overhired, and some CCAs are getting like 10 hours a week. And so throwing parcels is the only work they're getting. And as much as I hate to take that away from them, I also can't just stand by and let the contract be violated. So I think this is a violation. But in looking for grievance starters online, it's always grievances in the other direction. That, oh, a rural carrier did city work, or a clerk did carrier work, or a supervisor did carrier work. And I don't see any grievances that go the other direction. So if you have insight on this, please send it to me, classesofmail@gmail.com. Because what I'm thinking is, at first, if I file this grievance and management is found guilty of having CCAs cross craft, you know, doing stuff that's out of their job description, violating Article 7. I hope it's Article 7. Regardless, whatever article says, don't do that, except in emergency situations. Okay, fine. You know, they're probably still going to keep doing it because they don't have clerks. And so what I'm thinking more long term is, like, okay, well, if they keep doing it, now maybe I can start getting some compensation for those CCAs. Like, they can get out of schedule pay or get, you know, some other compensation for being asked to do work that's outside of their training, which would actually wind up being helpful for them. And maybe that would finally encourage management to hire some clerks instead of just making these CCAs do it. Or I've seen a potential remedy where the CCA would get paid whatever the highest level clerk gets paid, because that's whose work they're doing. If they're doing that kind of work, they deserve that kind of pay. So I'm going to try it. But here's the problem, right? And getting back to the topic at hand, I've asked CCAs, okay, write me a statement that, you know, this supervisor told me to throw the parcels and this is what time I started and so on. And then the CCAs never write that statement. And it's partly fear of management that they don't want their name on this thing that says, you know, hey, management did me wrong, because now management's going to cut their hours and, you know, it's this big mess. But instead, if I interview them and just ask them questions and they're truthful in their answers, then that's a very different vibe from that CCA. You know, where I say, like, were you working at our station on Tuesday? What time did you clock in? Did you work in the parcel pit that day? From what time to what time? And then, like, did management have you clock over to a different function on your scanner? And I know at my station, the answer to that is no. And so I'm thinking that even if it's not necessarily a cross-craft violation, and maybe it's not, maybe I'm barking up the wrong tree here, I can at least get management for falsifying time records. Because I asked the CCA who I was talking to about it today, well, what function are you on when you're in there throwing parcels? And he says, oh, I'm on office time. Well, management's giving us all this grief about we went 5 hours over on our office time yesterday. Yeah, because you got carriers doing clerk work on office time. So if that dude's in the parcel pit for a half hour throwing parcels, that's a half hour of office time that we shouldn't be dinged for. So anyway, that's statements, right? Statements, it turns out, are really important from CCAs, or not statements, rather interviews to draw those statements out of the CCA. So that's what I plan to do going forward. I will be doing a lot more interviews. And tomorrow morning at the morning stand-up, first thing I plan to do when I talk in my section is apologize for having inadequate grievances in the past and leaving the stuff on the vine and just not being that great at my job yet, but I will be getting better. And, you know, please just give me time and understand that there's going to be some growing pains as I'm learning this job. So hopefully people are understanding about that. I guess we'll see tomorrow. So anyway, that's statements from carriers. Now, getting statements from management, or rather interviewing management, is a whole other story. Like, when you're interviewing management, you're trying to get them to say things that incriminate them, say things that show that they didn't do the proper procedures, that trap them, things like that. And that part I already knew, but there were some nuances to it that I really liked, that I learned in this class. Like, one of the things that you should not do is you should not ask management if they're aware of a rule. Don't say, like, are you aware that in ELM 482.69 it says blah, blah, blah? Because it's their job to know that rule. That's part of being the manager, is that you need to know what your job is. It's not my job to make sure you know. It's your job to know as the supervisor. So instead, we need to just take it for granted that they know these rules. And if I ask them, are you aware that in ELM blah, 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 it says blah, 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 and they say, no, I wasn't aware of that. Okay, now what? What do I do with that information? Like, how is that going to help my case? So, better to just assume that they know the rule. And if I intend to show that they broke that rule, asking them if they're aware of it does not change the fact that they broke that rule. So, it's irrelevant anyway. So, that's that. All right, so that's interviewing management. And that's what I learned on day two. Then we go to lunch again and we come back for the wrap session. And this is exciting. We get all the carriers in one big room and there's a big dais up in the front with all these executives from the post office and or from the union in all these different capacities. And it starts out with, I don't know, an invocation, like we say the Pledge of Allegiance. There's a prayer and basic stuff. And then the National Business Agent for Region 1 gets up at the lectern and starts talking about our successes in arbitration, which is great. She says that we're winning like 84% of our arbitration cases and our DRT, our Dispute Resolution Team cases. So yay, good for us. And then she starts pulling up these slides that show that in the Hawaii district, they won, they had 32 cases, they won 21 cases, they modified 13 cases, and they lost 4 cases for a win percentage of 91%. And dude, it's just number after number after number. And they're up on these slides. You can read the numbers in about 3 seconds. And she reads number after number after number that we adjudicated this many cases, and we won this many, we modified this many, and we lost this many. And then she goes through arbitrator by arbitrator and says, this arbitrator, we had these many contract cases in front of him, and we won this many, and we lost this many, and we modified this many, and we had this many discipline cases. And dude, I mean, even just telling you about it, oh my God, it was so boring. Dude, there has got to be a better way. So we also had a nice memorial to my union president, my local union president, who died earlier this year, Glenn Norton. And that was really touching. They played, it was long. They played like 9 minutes, three songs, and just had a bunch of pictures of him up on the screens. And it was nice. It was touching. And some people had some nice things to say about him. So that was cool. Also there were Chris Jackson, the director of City Delivery, and Vice President James Henry. They both came up and spoke, and they were very well received. They got standing ovations, and they had great speeches. They were real rah-rah speeches that got people fired up, and it was wonderful. That's what leadership looks like, and I was very happy with what they had to say and with the way they came across. You know, it was nothing real substantive. It was just about like their love for the Carriers and that we're in this together and stuff like that. So it was all great. And then finally, it's time for Brian Renfro to speak. So he gets introduced and he gets applause, but nowhere near as rousing as the other two guys got. And, you know, it really, there was a vibe that he's this embattled president, and it diminishes his leadership capacity. You know, maybe some of that is just my own emotions being put onto the room, but I can't help it. You know, from the stuff I've heard on aid arbitration, from hearing that report about all of his bad behavior, I couldn't help but feel that vibe in the room. And so he stands up and he starts talking, and there's these two microphones in the aisles of the conference room. And somebody walks up and stands at one of the microphones. Now, mind you, I've never been to a rap session before, so I don't know that it's supposed to be like this back and forth or whatever. So there's just this dude standing up at the microphone, staring at Brian Renfro. And then finally, Renfro acknowledges him. And, you know, we're maybe 45 minutes in at this point. And the guy says, I don't remember exactly what he said, but it was something to the effect of, hey, I just want to give you this opportunity to apologize to us for flaking out on the previous rap session when he was drunk or whatever and didn't make it to one of these union meetings. So go ahead and do that now. And Brian says, well, I'm going to talk about that later. And the guy says, well, you know, we got time right now, and I know some people have to leave. They won't be able to stay all the way. So if you want to get it out of the way now, go ahead and give us your apology. And Brian says again, I'm going to talk about that later. So it gets dropped. The guy sits back down. He goes on with his speech. And then maybe an hour after that, somebody else is up at the microphone. They get acknowledged. And then they essentially say the same thing. Hey, don't forget that, you know, you were going to apologize to us. And he again says, oh, I'm going to get to that later. So that was interesting. Seeing that. And in the meantime, there were other people who rose with good questions about like the TRAP process and about what was some of the other stuff. It was, I don't know, it was fairly basic stuff. And honestly, Renfro probably talked for an hour and a half without saying anything substantial. Nothing noteworthy, nothing you could hang your hat on. It was just talk. You know, he would talk in these vague terms, like he's talking about the contract negotiations, and he'd say, you know, with finances, we come in way over here, you know, and he holds his hand out to one side, and management comes in way over there, and he holds his hand out to the other side, and then we got to meet somewhere. And he says, but, you know, generally management has been moving in our direction, and he moves his one hand closer to the other, and we feel pretty good about where we're headed. And at one point, somebody asked him about open bargaining, and he said that the problem is with open bargaining, with trying to engage the public and rally public support, is that you have to know who your opposition is. Who is this person across the table, the negotiating table? And he says that the person that's across the table from us, I think, would really push back against any public pressure. And I think it would actually make it harder for us to get an agreement if we tried to go the public route and engage the public in getting our demands met. And so he says, you know, that's my decision as a leader, and I'll bear the consequences if it winds up not being the right decision, or something to that effect. So, all right, you know, what am I going to say to that? I don't know what the story is there. But it occurs to me that that's only half of what open bargaining is talking about. part of it is about public engagement, but also is about being open with your own members and what they, you know, what are you doing for them? And so that was not addressed. So anyway, he goes on, and I took notes on my phone about things that he said that were concrete and things that he said that were kind of subjective or wishy-washy. So I'm going to grab my phone right now, and I'm going to tell you what my takeaways were from his speech. So let me do that right now. All right, here's the phone. So first we get to the things that are that he's just saying, like, generally, but, you know, not like, yeah, this is for sure going to happen. He wants us to be on a single pay table. And, you know, that seems pretty certain, but there's no guarantee. He said that he wants to end the TRAP process, that he will not be renewing it for, like, it expires in May or something, this new route adjustment, the electronic technology something, electronic route adjustment process, whatever it is. He says that when that expires, he has no intention of renewing it, and he's not going to put it in the new contract. He said that our portion of healthcare premiums are not going to go up, that the rates may still go up, but like we pay, you know, 25%, the post office pays 75% or whatever it is, and that will stay the same. I have that backward. These are the things that seem firm. Yeah. The starred ones are the ones that, never mind. So yeah, he was pretty firm on the single pay table that that's going to happen, that TRAP is going to end, that he's not renewing it, that our healthcare premiums, our portion will stay the same. And then you may have heard this elsewhere, but this is interesting. It seems like it's a done deal that we're going to have two additional overtime lists. There will be an overtime list where people still want to work 8 hours only. They don't want to work more than 8 hours in a day, but they're willing to work 8 hours in a day on their day off. So that will be an additional overtime list. And then there'll be another overtime list where you're willing to work up to 12 hours in a day, but you want to make sure your day off is locked in. So that will be an additional overtime list. What he said at the wrap session was that both parties actually came to the table with that proposal. And so that makes it pretty easy to agree on when both parties are actually asking for the same thing. So that's how that's going to work. And then, you know, the difficulty there is figuring out, like, okay, how does equitability work if you have now four different lists? So I don't know. Good thing I'm not on that committee that has to come up with how that's going to work. He talked about the food drive, and that since COVID, we had the food drive interrupted for COVID, and the haul has gone down tremendously. Like, we're not getting anywhere close to the volume that we used to get. It's like half. And so he said that this year, the postcards kind of suck and there's no bags, but that he's committed to next year that we're going to have good advertising postcards and that we're going to bring back getting grocery bags for people to fill up. So that's something. And then the last thing, I'll get to that in just a second. Let me skip ahead. So some of the things that he said that we're working on, but it's not guaranteed, but it is a strong bargaining point, is to try to get carriers a right of refusal with the 12 and 60 hour limits. It's been awarded in a number of grievances where management has continued to violate these rules so often that eventually the arbitrator will rule, okay, you can just say no and not get disciplined. That when you hit that limit, you can just go home and there's no discipline for it. And so we have all these cases now where arbitrators have given carriers that right, and he's going to try to get that into the national agreement. Who knows if that'll happen? Another thing that he talked about was he's still trying to eliminate the CCA position, but that may mean having a higher percentage of PTFs, where I guess the current percentage is like 12% PTFs and 88% full-time regular, and that the percentage of PTFs would have to go up. So that's something. And then also, this seems pretty firm that this is going to happen, but he was non-committal, is that our arrow keys are moving to electronic. And I mean, dude, this has to happen, of course, that we have to have these electronic arrow keys. Because that's what makes the key so valuable, is you steal one key and you can open up everything. But with electronic arrow keys, they wouldn't be nearly as valuable. Like, they'd only work for that day, or they'd only work in one geographic location, or whatever. There were a number of different proposals. Oh, on that note, I didn't write this down, but he was also talking about our uniform program and how broken it is. And he said that part of the problem is that now there's essentially only one vendor. Like, one uniform company bought all these other uniform companies, and they just keep jacking up the prices. And he said, when you have a situation like that, you have like one buyer that buys millions of garments, and you have one vendor, there should be a negotiation. And you agree upon prices, and that's how you control prices. And so it looks like something like that is in the works. And he said, in the meantime, our uniform allotment is just going to have to go up until this all gets fixed. So, again, there was nothing really firm on that. Oh, and he also talked about and said that the post office agreed that new hires should have a complete uniform from day one. And, dude, I absolutely agree with that. All right, and then the last thing. Well, sorry, buddy. So the last thing is I'm sitting there in the audience, you know, seeing these people come up and ask their questions. And I'm thinking to myself, boy, I'd like to ask a question. I wonder if I have a good question that I can ask. And so I hem and haw and I think about it, and I start thinking about that open bargaining. You know, that's something that I'm also pretty strongly in favor of. And he never addressed the second half of open bargaining. Like, why not be honest with your members and at least keep us informed? And so I decided that what I'm going to ask is for him to tell us flatly, what's he asking for? You know, like he said, well, let me tell you the question that I asked, because eventually I screwed up my courage. I was very nervous, and I got up there to the microphone, and he called on me, and I asked him, hey, you've mentioned that with salary negotiations, you know, the post office is over here, and we're over here, and now we're like both here, and we would all really like to know, what are those numbers? You know, what is it that we're asking for? What's on this hand? And what is it that the post office is almost there? What's on that hand? What are those actual numbers? And he says, well, I've said what that is. And I said, well, I haven't heard it. What are the numbers? And he says, well, I've been very clear about this. And, like, you know, he sounds angry, but maybe he's just speaking loud because I have a loud voice. I don't know. I actually have the audio of it. And if I could figure out a way to stitch it into this podcast, I would. But he says, well, let me pause and see if I can figure out a way to actually play this. Sorry, I thought I actually paused my recording while that was happening. Now I got to see if I can actually figure out a way to go back and cut all this dead air. If I can't, then sorry about that. Hopefully you, well, sorry about that if I can't figure it out. All right, so now I'm going to leave another brief pause, and then I'm going to play this, and hopefully it will pick up on the microphone. Here goes.
So, like, for new hires, why can't you tell us, like, where we are now, where they are now? I don't hear any numbers.
Table one, brother.
That's where we are at table one?
No.
I mean, no, like, what salary are we asking for? What are they asking for? And if you don't tell us, why won't you tell us? You tell management.
I told you. I don't hear any salary table one. I said very clearly, from a dollar perspective, where we started is the minimum where table one was.
Okay.
So that's now, that has changed probably anywhere from 150 to 200 times in different concepts. It's okay. Not, the process is not as simple as you write down a proposal and slide it across the table. It's not a linear process, sure. Like that, which is why I speak generally where we start, but that's the ballpark. table one is where we started. There's been times where there's scenarios where maybe it's been a little bit less, times where scenarios where it was a little bit more.
All right, so I can tell from my recording that at least was hearable. Maybe you have to turn it up, and if you couldn't hear it, well, sorry about that. I'm not very good at this, but that's what was asked, is what is the actual number that we're looking at for the new starting pay, and he said table one. So I pulled up the current one table, or the current table one pay chart, and it is $30 an hour, roughly $30 an hour. So, you know, it's something that's, he acts like he's been super open about this, but Lord knows that's the first time I've heard something firm about it. And it came up tonight at my local union meeting, and I mentioned, you know, that this is what he said, and my union president said, well, sure, he did say that, but do you believe him? And no, well, that's an entirely different question. So that was exciting. I got to ask him a question, and he got fired up, and hey, he answered the question. So there you go. $30 an hour. We'll see. We'll see what happens. But that'd be great, you know. And earlier on in the session, he did talk about, like, the post office generally agrees where we are on starting salary, because we have to attract more employees, and we have to attract higher quality employees. So hopefully that's true. We shall see. So that was about the end of the rap session. And then finally, for the last 2 minutes, he actually gave his apology and apologized for no showing on whatever the other meeting was that he didn't make it to, or the convention or whatever, and said that that was essentially when he hit rock bottom, and that he feels bad about it, and that he went into rehab or whatever right after that. So he did actually make his apology, and that was like the last 2 minutes of his speech. Credit where credit is due. Guy's a good speaker. You know, he's not real rah-rah. It wasn't motivating. I didn't leave energized, but I'll tell you what, he's really easy to understand. He speaks very clearly, and he speaks fluidly. He was able to just keep talking and keep talking. It didn't sound scripted. He spoke naturally. And, you know, again, a very easy to understand, good, strong voice. And there were some microphone problems during his talk. And for a while, he spoke without the microphone, and the entire room could hear him, no problem. So kudos to him on that. Credit where credit is due on that. And I do think that's something that's important for a leader, is to be able to be heard, like literally heard. So credit where credit's due. All right, and that was the rap session. Oh, no, and then afterward, we went to a rally, an Enough is Enough rally, and I marched in that, and that was cool. There were probably 60 carriers, would be my guess, and we marched down to a federal courthouse near where we were having the convention, and I enjoyed that as well. You know, we chanted, enough is enough, protect our letter carriers. And the thing that most impressed me about it is when we got to the courthouse, there were news teams from every local news channel there. And so that was really cool. You know, it shows that the community cares about this, that people think it's noteworthy. A lot of people who drove by honked, and man, I love that. I love when they honk. And I assume that all those honks were honks of solidarity. So awesome. That was really cool. And then also I got to speak with the regional administrative assistant who was helping with my Carrier Academy case, the one guy who actually seemed to care but had his hands tied. And we probably talked for about 10 minutes, and it went really well. And, you know, we kind of shared the same frustrations about the way the whole process is. Oh, and you know what? That was something else that came up actually during the rap session, was the primary complaint about the TRAP process was the alternative dispute resolution process, which has absolutely no teeth whatsoever. And obviously I agree with that, because that was the main problem with my Carrier Academy case. Is for that system to work, management has to sit down in the same room and be reasonable and come to a reasonable agreement. And if management decides not to do that, tough luck. You get nothing. And apparently, at some point in this TRAP process, when we started adding routes around the country, management realized, like, oh, we don't actually have to cooperate. And then they stopped cooperating. And so now the process is completely broken because the ADR process, the alternative dispute resolution process, is completely broken. And so that came up during the wrap session as well. And I don't remember what Renfro said about it. I don't remember. So I'm sure whatever it was, I don't know, I don't remember. So anyway, that was that. All right, now, the last thing I want to get to, I had my local union steward meeting this evening, and I'm just back from that. And I want to talk a little bit about what I think so far about being a union steward. Like, how's it going so far? And one of my big takeaways, so I've probably been an alternate steward for about a year now, maybe longer, but I hadn't really done anything for a long time. Now that I'm finally starting to handle some cases, maybe I've been doing that for like 3 months. And my first thought is, I'm not very good at it. I have been winning cases, but like I talked about with an attendance case that I won, got it knocked down to a letter of warning, did I really win that case? I don't know. You know, maybe I should have got it thrown out completely. And I just don't know. I don't have the experience yet. But I know that technically, I'm not good at it. You know, I'm motivated and I'm throwing myself into learning, as you know from listening to this podcast. But learning the contract doesn't make me skilled as a steward. It's important and it, you know, it's necessary. But that's different from knowing how to craft an argument, knowing what questions to ask, knowing what citations to make, knowing like physically how to put a file together, knowing how to fill out the 8190, which is our joint grievance form that we use with management. Like all that stuff is the stuff that I'm just not good at. I get calls like if I send a file up to the union hall, they call me back and they're like, hey, where's this paper? Oh, I didn't know I had to do that. You know, or, hey, you're not supposed to write in this section of the grievance form. And, oh, shit, I didn't know I was supposed to do that. So, like, for example, tonight at the steward meeting, one of our vice presidents was instructing people how to fill out block 15 of the 8190, which is where you write the issue statement that did management violate, you know, blah, blah, blah. And she says, look, when you're doing, like, a discipline case, just use the basic statement. Don't improvise. The basic statement is already laid out for you. Just use that. And I raised my hand like a dumbass because I am and said, what is the basic statement? Like, what is it that you want us to say? And she says, look on the back of the 8190 in part 15. And I flip over the paper and on the backside of it, on page 2, essentially, there's all these instructions, just like how you have instructions on the back of the 3996. There's all these instructions. And on line 15, it says, like, did management have just cause when they issued discipline or whatever it says in there? And she goes, you know, just write that. And like, dude, I never knew that was back there. You know, I just saw page 1 and then like page 2 and 3, just throw those away. I don't need those. I need page 1. This is what I have to fill out. Man, did I feel like a dum-dum when I read that. So that'll be part of my apology tomorrow with my station. I don't know if I'm going to bring that part up. But it goes to show you that, you know, I really have a lot to learn. Now, on the upside, I genuinely care about my coworkers. You know, I want them to be treated fairly. I want them to get a fair shake. I want management to treat them with dignity, and I want management to abide by the rules. I'm a rules guy. I've always been the rules guy. Back as a teenager, we used to play Magic the Gathering, that card game, and I was the rule book. Whenever there was a rules question, people would just ask me, and I knew those rules inside and out. And that's always been who I am. When I learn a new game, I read the rules. Okay, got it. Let's go. So that's a strength, but I know I'm going to keep making mistakes. I know I'm going to miss things. Things are going to be incomplete. I'm going to be functionally defective sometimes. I still have a hard time with organization. Like, there's just so many papers. And so I bought all these color-coded folders, and I got to try to figure out like a good way to use them. Because, man, it's so many papers. So, you know, I'm learning. But my big concern is that the mistakes that I make are going to cost my fellow carriers. Every time I mess up a defense to discipline, that carrier gets discipline that maybe they shouldn't have had. And that really bothers me. And so that motivates me to try to be the best carrier that I can and put in the time and study and you know, try to get better and reach out for help. Like the NALC Facebook groups have been great. They've been super helpful because I don't like calling my union hall because of the interactions that I've had with my union president, which I've talked about on previous podcasts. And that sucks. You know, I really want to be comfortable reaching out to help to the people who are right next to me. But instead, I wind up going on to Facebook or other places for that, or calling a buddy of mine who's a union steward. So that's that part of it. The other part of it where I really need to get better is I'm still putting in most of my time on these grievances at home, where I bring the files home and I do my research at home. And I write most of, like, I'm writing my interview questions at home. And I know I should be doing all that stuff at work on the clock, but I really feel uncomfortable asking management for time just because I'm incompetent, just because I don't know what I'm doing. And I don't like asking management for that time. So, like, tonight is a good example. I'm working on this defense to discipline of a carrier who had a lot of absences, and they wrote him up for unacceptable attendance. And on the charge letter, they also included M41-112.22, which says that carriers should report to work promptly as scheduled. And in my head, that's tardiness, not absence. You know, promptly as scheduled means you need to show up on time. And so I spent like at least a half an hour, probably longer, trying to find citations that back that up, that back my interpretation of it, that it's not talking about absences. Because if that's in his file, and he gets discipline that includes being late when he was never late, well, now going forward, if he's late one day, they can cite this prior discipline. It's like, look, we've already disciplined him for being late, and this is a 14-day suspension. So now what happens is, like, there's traffic one day, he shows up late, they could just fire him because he's already had a 14-day for being late. So I'm hoping that a defect like that, along with some of the other things that I found, will be enough to get this discipline thrown out completely. But I don't know, because I'm new, you know? And so I guess I'm going to learn. And as I learn, I'm going to help you guys learn too, because I bet a lot of you guys have the same kind of questions that I have. So that's it. That's where I stand. That's how things are going. That's what happened at the Region 1 training and the wrap session. And I promise I'm going to get better. And maybe one day I'll even get better at podcasting. Don't hold your breath on that one. This podcast is a big part of my learning process, and I appreciate you guys being there for it. I appreciate all the feedback. Again, feel free to write me if you have questions, CoachAllen@gmail, or that's my regular email address, classesofmail@gmail.com, because I do eventually want to do a question and answer episode. And if you have topic suggestions, by all means, write me with those also. So thanks for listening, guys, and I will catch you next time.